You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio, and that's the music of Meatloaf. The song is Bat Out of Hell. It's a selection of our guest in this hour, Amy Jill Levine, Jewish professor of New Testament, coming up on Sunday night. Following Amy Jill Levine, and lots more, of course, on Sunday night. The Inquisition at Midnight, after the Midnight Inquisition, some tunes to keep you going, and then Bill Ledbetter will join us in the chat room. But now, let's hear a little more of Meatloaf, the sounds of the 60s, Bat Out of Hell. Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell. Meatloaf is a selection of our guest, the Professor of New Testament at Vanderbilt University in the United States, although perhaps that's an inadequate description of our guest, Amy Jill Levine. Amy Jill Levine, you may be able to tell by her name, is not exactly traditional in her Christian upbringing. Amy Jill Levine, you describe yourself for us.
I'm a Yankee, Jewish, indeed member of an Orthodox synagogue, feminist, who teaches Christian ministerial candidates at Vanderbilt University Divinity School in Nashville, Tennessee, a place we like to call the buckle of the Bible Belt.
And now, please, you've got to add why you chose Meatloaf as a piece of music to introduce our discussion.
Yeah, well, it's not as if Bat Out of Hell explains my spiritual state, but the passion of this music and the fabulous orchestration, I think, is the perfect tape to listen to as I'm driving home from work. If I'm upset with whatever happened in a committee meeting or my students have not performed as well as I would hope, if I can sing along with Meatloaf, by the time I'm home, I'm quite happy.
Now, there's a resonance we can identify with. Tell us why you a young Jewish girl would at some point in life decide that the New Testament and the life of Jesus is worthy of your attention?
I think it's worthy of everybody's attention, regardless of whether the individual is Jewish or Christian or atheist or Martian. It's a phenomenal book with stories, particularly the stories about Jesus and the stories Jesus tells, which everybody, I think, needs to pay attention to.
At what point in your life did you decide that Christianity rather than Judaism was going to be where you, as a Jewish scholar, would give your attention?
I was 7 years old when I first became formally interested. And I was a precocious young child as well. I grew up in a neighborhood that was predominantly Roman Catholic and Portuguese, so my introduction to Christianity was ethnic Roman Catholicism, which was wonderful. It was saints and great food and a warm, loving community, and plus it had bunnies and Santa. My parents had told me that Christianity was much like Judaism. We worshiped the same God. We both took authority from the same book. We followed the Ten Commandments. And moreover, Christians thought a Jewish man named Jesus was very important. So I think I had an original sense that Christianity was somewhat like the synagogues in my town, to which we did not go. It was, you know, in the family, but not quite right. When I was in second grade, my fascination with Christianity came to a head with two events. First, all of my friends were preparing to make their first Holy Communion, so I decided I had to do that as well. I wanted the bride dress, basically. The accessories alone make this a worthwhile initiation, right? And I couldn't do that, and that upset me. And then midway through the school year, a little girl said to me on the school bus, "You killed our Lord," because she had been taught that the Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus, and not just some back in the first century, but all Jews for all time. And I simply couldn't put together how this tradition, which had struck me as so beautiful and so moral and so warm and loving, could say such hateful things. So I started to ask questions. Then I was 7. I'm now 52. So clearly I've been invested in this for a long time. I found that the more I studied the New Testament, even from those initial stories I heard when I was a child, I was actually able to recover some of my own Jewish history. Jesus is a Jew talking to other Jews. His initial followers are Jews. So in learning about early Christianity, I actually learn about early Judaism as well.
It's a remarkable resource as a set of books, both the Old and the New Testament. It's one of those windows on a past which takes us not just into the facts, but into the lives and the heart of people. Many people would acknowledge through the work of Geza Vermish and other great scholars that, okay, Jesus was a Jew. That's one question. The thing that people, particularly Christians, have trouble accommodating themselves to is that Jesus was Jewish.
Yes, that's a very good distinction to draw. So when I mention to my students or to church groups with whom I work, Jesus was Jewish, they'll say, well, yes, that's fine. But they have no content to the label. And what I want to do is put that content back on and locate him securely as a part of his culture rather than apart from it. Jesus follows the mitzvot, the commandments. He even wears fringes, the Hebrew would be tzitzit, because that's what the hemorrhaging woman seeking a healing reaches out to touch. He honors the Sabbath and keeps it holy. He debates how to practice Judaism, which Jews have been debating, I think, since Moses came down the mountain. His initial followers are recognized as members of the Jewish community. They're worshiping in the Temple of Jerusalem. They're reading the same text, the Hebrew scriptures that Jews would have read. And in the early first century, making the proclamation that someone was the Messiah was not off the Jewish charts. There were, in fact, many Messianic claimants.
And Messianic Judaism continues to be a lively part of the Jewish tradition.
It's a lively part of people who claim to be Jews today, but a very controversial position as well.
Let's talk a little bit more about this Jewishness of Jesus and what it has helped Christians recover, as well as Jews recover, about who Jesus was and about the power of the stories.
If we start with the stories and we recognize that Jesus is a Jew talking to other Jews, the stories take on infinitely more import than they have in churches today, where unfortunately, I think, they've become domesticated. For example, if Jesus begins a parable by saying, "There was a father who had two sons," early Jews would not say, "Oh, this is the parable of the prodigal son," and just focus on the younger. They would say, "Oh, a father who had two sons, I recognize that." That's Adam with Cain and Abel. That's Abraham with Ishmael and Isaac. That's Isaac with Jacob and Esau. They already know the basic plot line. And then because these are parables, which always twist the conventional, they see new meaning not only in Jesus' story, but in the ancient stories that they've inherited.
Yeah, so the purpose of the parallel is to actually give meaning at depth to the tradition, not just to that story.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that when we listen to Jesus, we can hear him historically with first century Jewish ears. We can recover his punch and his power, and we can figure out why some people would give up their homes and their families to follow him and die for him. Others thought he was crazy, and still others thought he was so sufficiently dangerous that he needed to be killed.
There is power in those stories, but there is also power in the context of the stories. For many years, certainly as I grew up, a young kid going to Sunday school in a pretty traditional Protestant environment, the Pharisees are portrayed as the bad guys. Yet much of the recovery of understanding of the Jewish tradition of Jesus gives us a more nuanced perception of actually Jesus' dialogue with the Pharisees. And it's not all about bad guys and good guys.
Right. Once we move into some sort of dualistic manner in which the so-called Christian characters are all good and the Jewish characters represented by the Pharisees are all bad, we have stereotyped history and we've misread the text. The Pharisees have various roles in the first century. They become, for the Gospels, to some extent, stock villains. But if we actually listen to the debates in which Jesus and the Pharisees engage, they're in agreement with about 90% of how to practice.
In fact, the reason why they're stock villains is because they are the ones, in a sense, closest to him.
They're certainly closest to him in terms of various beliefs regarding things like resurrection of the dead or how to adapt biblical law to first century changing circumstances. But they're also the rivals or the representation of the rivals of the early church, the people who lived at the time that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are writing. So the gospel writers, the evangelists, used the Pharisees to represent the synagogue down the street that did not sign on to the Christian program.
Let's talk then briefly about the nature of this message that Jesus was bringing and how it sat in that environment, that first century environment. What was radical about it in terms of Judaism?
Let's go first with what was not radical about it, because here's where I find a number of Christians get mistaken. A number of my Christian friends will say, Jesus invented the idea of love of God and love of neighbor. He developed the idea of the great commandment. What they fail to recognize is that love of God is Deuteronomy 6 and love of neighbors is Leviticus 19. Where he is distinct, although not completely anomalous in his concerns for social justice, is in his statement, for example, that all debt should be forgiven. He's following here the prophet Habakkuk, who complains about people holding things in debt. And Jesus takes that to its logical conclusion. He says, if you have more than you need and someone else is starving, you give. You don't put away money for the vacation home or the second car. He's saying that people should be treated as if they are members of your own family, which means that loyalty to God and loyalty to the community outstrip and outweigh marriage or biology. As he puts it, who are my mother and brothers and sisters? It's those who hear the will of God and do it. That means I have to have as much concern for your children as I do for my own, and that's tough.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guest, Professor Amy Jill Levine, Vanderbilt University Professor of New Testament, a Jewish scholar teaching Christians about the Bible and about Jesus in particular. Let's have a piece of music. Kathleen Battle and Christopher Parkening, you've selected, and the music of John Dowland, English composer, somebody who a number of people, including Sting, have taken an interest in recently. Why have you chosen John Dowland?
It's not only John Dowland, it's the performance that I find that Kathleen Battle does, plus the guitar work where he so elegantly manages to get out of her way. So we have this fabulous singer and this delicate music behind. So it's the combination of the performances, the words, and the music that I think crosses the centuries just elegantly.
Come again, sweet love doth now invite, thy graces that refrain to do me due.
Kathleen Battle and Christopher Parkening. Music of John Dowland. Come Again, Sweet Love Doth Now Invite. It's a selection of our guest, Professor Amy Jill Levine of Vanderbilt University in the United States, Professor of New Testament at Vanderbilt. Amy Jill, your interest in music is not simply casual. You are actually something of a scholar in music as well, and the diversity of your selections reinforces that. Does the music thing come out of the religious tradition as well?
It actually doesn't. I hold a joint appointment at the Blair College of Music, part of Vanderbilt University, where I teach a course with a musicologist on the Bible and classical music. But my musicologist friends sometimes refer to my taste in music positively as eclectic and more often as unfortunate. My grandmother was a concert pianist, and I grew up with music in the household. I am an adequate musician. My mother, the intervening generation, was a dreadful clarinet player. But I love the idea of music, and I honor those people who have the technical gift to be able to perform it. My son is a violinist, so I'm very much interested in violin, the violin concerto as a musical form, and I'm interested in listening to him play as well.
Music, though, influences religious cultures enormously. I mean, it's the cry of the heart, the creed of cœur, so often that music becomes, or the aesthetics of music, are very tightly entwined, and you get in the lyrics of Dowland or others, with who I am as a person. And there is a sense of poetry and aesthetic in much of the New Testament writing. If I go to those stories that Jesus told, particularly those parables about the widow's mite and other things, there's almost a construction in them which has a certain rhythm about it and resonance, which isn't, it's not about the logic of the story, is it?
I think it's both the logic of the story and the aesthetic by which the story is conveyed. So form and substance do work very well together. The early church, like the early synagogue, conveyed its material in story form and had to do so orally because most people in antiquity are illiterate. So in order to be able to remember the stories have to take on a form that is itself memorable. The same thing with music. If you come out humming a tune, you're more likely to remember the context in which that tune first took place.
Let's continue this discussion about the way Christianity, and particularly Jesus' teaching, emerges to form a distinct group within Judaism. We spoke of Jesus as a Jewish teacher. But nevertheless, following Jesus' death and the events surrounding his death, a group of people emerged within Judaism who said, we have a distinct body of thought here. You get it around the first church forming around James. To what extent, and you explore this in your book, at what point does this begin to emerge into something different? You talk about a two-track emergence here of a way of thinking about themselves as a distinct group.
They're both a distinct group, and within the first several centuries, they're also part of Judaism. Just as one could say in Christianity, the Anglican Church is a distinct group within the wider Christian communion, but we still recognize it as part of the Christian communion related to the Roman Catholic Church or to Lutherans or Presbyterians or Methodists. So the early followers of Jesus are a recognizably distinct group, as would the Essenes be, as would the Pharisees be. But they're not separated from Judaism writ large. It's very difficult to determine that particular moment, you know, some Tuesday in the year 520, at which Jews and Christians suddenly completely parted company. The division is gradual. It happens at different times in different locations, and most likely for different reasons. Indeed, even when the people who are writing our histories, the church fathers, the rabbis, are suggesting a complete split, archaeological evidence, and even hints in the documents themselves, suggest that on the ground, followers of Jesus within the Jewish community and those who did not follow Jesus are still sharing Sabbath dinner, are still attending synagogue together, still see themselves as part of the same broad family.
The moment Gentiles begin to come into the fellowship, does this mark a moment when things start to divide, start to separate?
It's difficult to tell if things are starting to separate or whether they were actually separate from the beginning. The Gentiles whom Paul converts and whom other Jewish followers of Jesus converted were never part of Judaism to begin with. They come into the church as Gentiles. They're not following Jewish law. They're not circumcising their males. They're not keeping Jewish dietary regulations.
So at the same time, we have a Jewish church and a Gentile church coexisting?
Early on, we do, in fact. And it wasn't a huge problem because that early church was also expecting Jesus to be returning quite soon. And in that heightened moment where one is expecting the full glory of the kingdom of God to break in, you can hold different traditions, different practices, different views. The problem was that Jesus did not come back. And then the church had to figure out, well, will it go fully Jewish? Should it convert those Gentiles to Judaism first? Should the Gentiles stay Gentiles and the Jews stay Jews in terms of practice? And different people in the church came up with different answers.
And at this point also, I guess the Jewish establishment had to have different responses to this sect as well.
The Jewish establishment did. The problem is locating a clear Jewish establishment. There was never some head Jew that all Jews would listen to. I can't even imagine that in my own synagogue where I argue with my rabbi. So you've already got differences within the broader Jewish community. Pharisees and Sadducees are not the best of friends. The people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls only apparently liked other people in that community and weren't too thrilled with Pharisees or Sadducees. So different groups of Jews then would have had different reactions to Messianic claimants.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. Our guest, Professor Amy Jill Levine, Professor of New Testament at Vanderbilt University. Let's have another piece of music. I'd love your selections. It's just really a pleasure to talk you through them. We're going to now have a listen to Mozart. Mozart's Violin Concerto. Mozart, the quintessential sort of classical musician. Why Mozart?
Well, when it comes to violin music, and here Mozart's third and Prokofiev's second are my favorites, in part because I have very, very pleasant memories of my son, who's a violinist, practicing these pieces and agonizing over certain measures and going back and back and back. But when he finally mastered those, not only was the music beautiful, my own pride as a mother in listening to my son perform, and I tried to be as objective as possible and say, oh yes, this isn't my child I'm listening to. I love the music, and I love the memories these pieces bring to me of my son's childhood.
Thank you.
Mozart, the Violin Concerto No. 3, a selection of our guest, Professor Amy Jill Levine. Let's talk a little about the emergence of the church out of Judaism, and particularly, we've spoken about the Jewishness of Jesus, but the other significant figure, of course, in the emergence of Christianity out of Judaism is Paul.
Indeed.
Paul, too, is a Jew. We haven't yet seen the weight of scholastic work on the Jewishness of Paul that we have on Jesus. Yet there's a sense in which Paul's Jewishness and the nature of it is as interesting, if not more interesting, than Jesus, because Paul is the one who marks the great divide for many people.
Well, he's certainly involved in creating the great divide. Paul is a Jew, but his own self-identification varies as one goes from text to text. In 1 Corinthians, he describes himself as all things to all men, and that's very, very difficult to maintain. Sometimes he speaks from within Judaism and speaks proudly of being a Jew, a Pharisee of the tribe of Benjamin, circumcised on the eighth day, and he can certainly trot out his Jewish credentials. In other occasions, he speaks of his former life in Judaism. Paul, I don't think, is a systematic theologian. He's writing ad hoc letters to individual communities facing distinct problems. So I don't expect that we have to look at him as lockstep. Paul's own theology develops over time.
Now, there's something very interesting you raise there before we go on with that track. You say Paul is not a systematic theologian, yet for much of Christian history, many denominations have taken St. Paul and his letters as propositions to be read almost philosophically as coherent logical streams of thought, and one is built logically upon the other. You're saying, no, that's the wrong way to approach Paul. Paul is a man of some passion dealing with immediate situations?
I do think Paul is a man of passion dealing with immediate situations, but I also think that in certain cases, one can find a consistent view. I mean, I think his view of the Christ is consistent. I think his view of eschatology, of when the end of the world is going to come, changes a little bit. In 1 Thessalonians, his earliest document, the end is coming very soon. By the time he writes Romans, he's planning on doing a missionary trip to Spain. He's got his tickets booked. The end is not coming quite so soon. In 1 Thessalonians, he talks about the Jews who killed the Lord Jesus and has some quite negative things to say about them. When he writes Romans, he attempts to make clear his love of his fellow Jews, his relatives, as he puts it, his kinsmen by race, and insists that the various promises given to the Jewish community are still in place. So Paul here, I think, adapts his theology, recognizes that perhaps some of those earlier quite negative comments might have been said in the heat of passion, and in his more reflective epistle to the Romans, he changes his mind.
Do you like Paul?
I am ambivalent about Paul. Sometimes I like Paul very much. I think some of his biblical readings are brilliant. I think his passion is clear. I think his pastoral sense about helping communities live with one another, about dealing with dissension in the ranks, I think he's incredibly pastoral, psychologically quite profound. Sometimes he just confuses me. And every once in a while, he very much annoys me, particularly certain comments regarding women.
Well, let's take those comments regarding women. One could read them as Paul basically reasserting a very conservative role for women. Others could say, well, look, in the context of his time, he's actually not too bad. Where do you place him?
Yeah, he's basically consistent with the context of his time. Women in the first century in the Roman Republic are gaining new roles. It would be likely that women coming into his churches in places like Corinth or Rome would have expected leadership positions in the church because they had leadership positions in some of the Roman religious establishments, and they also had leadership positions in the synagogues in the diaspora, in synagogues in Roman and Greek contexts. Paul, on the one hand, in 1 Corinthians, seems to foreclose women's roles in the church, tells them to be silent, tells them to be submissive. On the other hand, in his epistle to the Romans, he mentions a woman who is a deacon, and he uses the masculine form of deacon, and he mentions a woman who is an apostle. So again, it depends upon which passage of Paul one reads.
And this, of course, traces for you with an interest in feminism, a line back through Paul to Jesus and the women who surrounded Jesus. Do you see a consistent liberation story here? particularly if we go back to the story of the tomb and the Mary at the tomb, and some say here is a woman as the first messenger of the gospel. This is a clear, because of the context in which it is written, it is very clear that a statement is being made here about the place of women.
There is a statement being made about the place of women in those resurrection announcements, which is that women can serve as witnesses and people will sometimes listen to them. But that should not be surprising because we've got evidence of that in Jewish sources as well. So I don't think the women surrounding Jesus are in any sort of anomalous position in terms of being liberated. It's very common to hear in Christian preaching and teaching that Jesus liberated women from this oppressive, patriarchal, misogynistic, horrible, reified, disgusting Judaism that made the Taliban look progressive, and that Jesus comes along as some sort of first century feminist. I don't think that's the case. Indeed, the Gospels themselves give us insights into Jewish women's history. There are women supporting Jesus out of their own funds, which means that Jewish women held their own funds. Jewish women own homes. Martha welcomes Jesus into her home. The early church meets at the house of Mary, the mother of John Mark, in the high rent district of Jerusalem. Women have freedom of travel, as we see with the women who followed Jesus from Galilee to Judea, or the story of the visitation of Mary to her cousin Elizabeth. Women appear in public and have public religious roles. There's a woman in the synagogue, the so-called bent-over lady whom Jesus heals. There are women in the temple in Jerusalem, from the old widow who greets baby Jesus according to the Lucan Christmas story, to the widow who puts her two coins, the widow's mite, who puts her two coins into the temple, to the daughters of Jerusalem who follow Jesus on the road to the cross. So women are themselves granted quite a number of roles in early Judaism. The one place where I think Jesus might be a little anomalous is that the women who surround him seem to be without husbands. Mary Magdalene, Mary and Martha. We know the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, followed their sons into the movement, but old man Zebedee stays back in Galilee with the boats. Joanna, the wife of Herod Stewart, follows Jesus. Her husband's back in the Galilee as well.
So here is a story which is again consistent with Jewish tradition, but has a progressive sense about it.
It's progressive in the sense that early Judaism itself was progressive. Early Judaism allowed women numerous religious roles and social roles, and Jesus' Jewish followers picked up on those. But early Judaism, for the most part, thought that women's primary role was to be married and to have children, and that was man's primary role as well. And Jesus says, much like the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, no, perhaps celibacy is also a gift we might want to consider. And it may well have been that women who did not have children or who did not have husbands found a new family around Jesus.
And how does that flow into St. Paul and your concerns about Paul, you know, and the women being covered in church? Is there a consistent line there in the teaching about women that emerges into this Christian community?
Paul recognizes women as full members of his communities, just as Jesus recognized women and just as the synagogue recognized women. There is a concern for celibacy, continence, and chastity in Paul, as I see in the early Jesus tradition. Paul, as a first century Jew, follows up on ancient stories regarding women. He'll use the story of Sarah and Hagar, for example, as a model for understanding how church life should function. So Paul and Jesus, I think, are consistent here. Women have social roles. Women have religious responsibilities. Women are spiritually equal to men. For just as in the Jewish tradition, both male and female are created in the image and likeness of God, so too for Jesus and Paul, both male and female have roles in the church and in the synagogue.
Where does the male headship thing emerge then in the church? Where do you see the priestly function, the all-male priestly function, emerging out of the New Testament? Do you see any warrant for it in the New Testament at all?
The priestly function was known both in Judaism and in pagan sources. Everybody had priests, and the job of the priest was to offer sacrifice. They're technicians. And it was typically the case that it was the man who offered the sacrifice. Some of my students will say it's like men who do barbecuing. So that the early church, coming from both a Jewish and a pagan background, would have expected men to perform those priestly traditions should not be surprising. But the early church was focused in the home. There were no church buildings. People met in private homes, which meant that for the early church, the people facilitating the worship would have been women, because it's women who would have been host at the table. It's women who would have welcomed people into the home, female domestic space.
Yes, it was the territory they owned.
Indeed.
That determined the early shape of things. In fact, the table meal.
Indeed. Jesus met around the table, just as Pharisees met around the table, just as people in the temple in Jerusalem met around the table. And as the church developed, the table continued to be a table. They simply started to call it an altar. But it's still a table around which members of a family share a common meal. And that's the Eucharist, but it's also the table of the Jewish home, and it's the altar of the Jerusalem temple.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guest, Amy Jill Levine, Professor of New Testament at Vanderbilt University in the United States, visiting us here in Australia, self-described as a Yankee Jewish feminist and a musical aficionado of some stature. Amy Jill Levine, let's have another piece of music. I love this. You've chosen Frank Sinatra, Mack the Knife, which of course has connections back to German-Jewish tradition.
Indeed,
with
does.
Bertolt Brecht and his writings, but this particular version is one that's become synonymous with Sinatra. It's with Hank Jones, Frank Sinatra, Mack the Knife.
Oh, the shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mac Heath, dear, and he keeps it way out of sight. When that shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows, they begin to spread. Fancy white gloves, though, has Mac Heath, dear. So there's barely ever one trace of red on the sidewalk. One Sunday morning lies a body oozing life. Someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone perhaps perchance be Mack the Knife? From a tugboat on the river going slow, a cement bag, it is dropping down. Yeah, the cement, just for the weight, dear. You can make a large bet Mack Heath is back in town. My man Louis Miller, he split the scene, babe, after drawing out all the breath from his stash. Now Mack Heath spends just like a pimp. Hey, do you suppose that our boy, he did something rash? You better lock your door and call the law, because Mac Heath, that bum, he's back in town.
Mack the Knife, Frank Sinatra with Hank Jones. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest, Amy Jill Levine, Professor of New Testament at Vanderbilt University in the United States, visiting Australia at the moment. Amy Jill Levine, you've taken us on a journey from Jewishness into the church through Jesus and Paul. The issues which confront us today are in some ways issues which have not challenged us in just the way they are at the moment for many, many years. That is, we're standing at a point in history where, to quote the cliche, the clash of civilizations is being argued about. That is, we have passed the the competing secularist agendas, capitalism and communism, are now seen as that fight's over. It's now your cultural sensibility, in particular religion, which is seen as one of the great markers. You're somebody who, through your writings, has actually made a contribution to what's broadly called interfaith dialogue. Is it possible for traditions who each believe they contain the truth to talk to each other, even from conservative perspectives?
I think it's possible. I also think it's necessary. Interfaith dialogue does not mean that one sacrifices the particularities of one's tradition on the altar of interfaith sensitivity. I don't enter into dialogue with a Christian or a Muslim, a Buddhist or an atheist, presuming that I'm going to convert that person to my view. Now, if that happened, that would be fabulous, but it's unlikely and that's not my goal. My goal is rather to understand how my neighbor understands his or her own scripture, his or her own tradition, beliefs, and practices, and then also to help my neighbor understand what I am doing. And if in that conversation I learn a little bit more about myself, which is usually what happens, I think that's all to the good. Interfaith dialogue, when it works, should prompt what the great Lutheran theologian Christer Stendahl called holy envy, the ability to see a glimmer of truth or insight or beauty in a tradition that is not one's own, so that I can walk into a cathedral or go to a mass or read the theology of a Christian colleague and think, you know, there's something there that speaks to me, sometimes aesthetically, sometimes intellectually, sometimes spiritually, and I get a glimmer of the divine. Ideally, when I can introduce Judaism to a Christian colleague, that Christian colleague could see a little bit of that same beauty, that same inspiration. I don't believe that any of us has a complete lock on the truth. The transcendent is more than any particular religion.
We've talked about the interrelationship between Christianity and Judaism, the one thing that emerges out of them, that there is a basis for conversation. Islam is the other religion of the book. To what extent is that conversation possible with Islam at the moment, and where do you see the opportunities for intersection? I mean, one could almost say that Judaism and Islam share more in common than Christianity and Judaism at one level.
Indeed they do, and at Vanderbilt we will frequently get Muslim students. I also teach in a maximum security prison every week when I'm in the States, and I have Muslim students in my prison classes as well. I find that I, as a Jew, have more in common theologically with my Muslim students than my Trinitarian Christian students, and the Muslims find that as well, and we all find this quite a delightful surprise. The dialogue is distinct, because although Jews and Christians share a same set of scriptures, what Jews would call the Tanakh and Christians would call the Old Testament, the Quran is different. And here we don't have in the West the knowledge of the Quran as Jews and Christians would have of, say, Genesis or Isaiah. So we have to learn more. The question of the Middle East invariably will intersect in any religious dialogue, often between Jews and Christians, and pretty much always when Islam enters the discussion. Can it be done? Yes. Must it be done? Absolutely.
Let me touch on one other area, because we're rapidly running out of time. There is a lot of emphasis, particularly these days, as we see, as I said, the clash of civilizations and people saying, look, it's because people no longer have coherent sets of belief. There are no universals to bind us anymore. So Western civilization in particular is becoming sloppy and weak. And some say, look, all that's going to be left ultimately, the only thing we have to depend on ultimately is the nuclear family. You hear that being spoken of consistently. Recently with World Youth Day and the Catholic Church in Australia. To what extent was Jesus a proponent of the nuclear family? I mean, one could see in Jesus, in some ways, you could read Jesus as the anti-family prophet. He's saying something else.
In the United States, one speaks about family values, which becomes a code term for mummy, daddy, and me. Where mummy stays home and daddy goes off to work and the kids are perfectly polite, above average, and never interrupt adults and don't watch violent television. Jesus' own family values, I think, are family values we need to consider, because I think he's probably right. He doesn't care whether you're married or not. He doesn't care what your sexual background is, or indeed how many times you've been married, as we see with the story of the Samaritan woman at the well in John 4. He doesn't actually care all that much in terms of what you've done in the past. What he wants you to do, which is what most religious traditions teach, is repent, reform your life, love God, love neighbor, and what is hateful to you, don't do to anybody else. Indeed, do to others as you would have them do to you. For him, it is not important that women get married and have babies. It is not important, indeed, that people procreate at all. I think he's more interested in people becoming like little children rather than having them. He offers opportunities for married couples. He offers opportunities for the celibate. He says, meet me where you are, which is indeed what the Jewish tradition itself says. Meet me where you are and see if together we can form a community that will embrace all people. The other thing he says, which I think is quite helpful, is he says, don't judge others, which I think too many people involved in the family values movement or the nuclear family movement do. They say, if you're not part of this family system, there's something wrong with you. You're unfulfilled. He says, don't judge others. Worry about getting the log out of your own eye before you worry about the speck in your brother's eye. Look to yourself, look to what you're doing, and try to live a better life.
Harold Bloom, the great American literary writer, has suggested that much of contemporary American fundamentalist Protestantism, the televangelist sort of culture, is in fact Gnostic rather than Christian. And one looks at groups like Focus on the Family, groups like that, and you say, well, at what point are they attached to either Judaism or Christianity, or are they on about something else? Are they in fact a reassertion of a different tradition altogether? And that's this deeply visceral, almost pagan lock onto the family tradition.
I think that's overstated. And too often I find that some of the more conservative organizations like Focus on the Family are unfortunately stereotyped. The great problem is, I don't think religion, the great problem is ultra-fundamentalism, which we find in all religious traditions. Focus on the Family, I think, is quite consistent with certain aspects of early Christianity, just as more liberal groups within the Christian communion are associated with those aspects. Are they Gnostic? The term Gnosticism itself can be defined variously, but generally Gnosticism is very much an individualistic religion. I, through my knowledge, can achieve salvation. I don't have to deal with people, you know, next door to me. I don't have to form a church.
Seven effective habits of highly effective people.
Pretty much so. But what Gnosticism does is eliminate community. Focus on the Family, indeed, does not eliminate community. It forms community. The televangelist is a problem because the idea is you can find community simply by watching your television set on Sunday morning and sending in a check. That, to me, is not community, and I would much rather see more effort in terms of what the early church and synagogue did, which is not simply writing a check but keeping your hands clean, but going out and welcoming the poor, welcoming the disenfranchised, and actually being neighbor to somebody with whom you might not want to be neighbor.
In yourself, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the capacity of religious institutions of any sort, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, to retain that sense of community in the face of the assault of technology that's provided by television and everything else? I mean, the assault of consumerist individualism is enormous, particularly in the United States.
It's enormous, but for every step technology takes in one direction, neighborliness, justice, and compassion can also be there. And sometimes technology can actually help us function in terms of neighborliness. So I look at technology more as an opportunity rather than a threat. My sense of what human beings can do is shaped substantially by the time I spent in the Philippines in 2004 living in a Mary Knoll convent and working with these Mary Knoll sisters, with the poorest of the poor in the slums of the Philippines, and recognizing just what a touch can do, what a hot meal can do, what consistent concern and connection can do rather than just a one-off meeting. And they do this in part through technology. It was technology that put me in touch with these ladies through email. It's technology that got me over there on the airplane. But it's that one-on-one connection, that community role, the sense of these women, which has been in place for over a century, that gives me some sense of optimism.
Amy Jill Levine, great to have you on Sunday night. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's finish with a piece of music, and this is delightful. Gilbert and Sullivan, the Mikado. There Is Beauty. Why have you chosen this?
Well, it's not just There Is Beauty. There is beauty in the bellow of the blast. The idea of finding love between extremely unlikely people. The idea of finding beauty in something which is quite unpleasant. And this marvelously gentle song brings about a sense that you can really find something decent pretty much anywhere you look. And if you have good orchestration behind it, it's much easier.
A Little Gilbert and Sullivan from the Mikado. Coco and Katishar's duet, There Is Beauty. Amy Jill Levine, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I like to see a tiger from the Congo or the Niger, and especially for gnashing in his tail.
For volcanoes have a splendor that is grim, and the earthquake only tend behind the doors. But to him who's scientific, there is nothing that's terrific in the falling of a flight of thunderbolts.
Yes, in spite of all my meekness, if I have a little weakness, it's a passion for a flight of thunderbolts. If that is so soon, very now, very it's evident, very out is our one. Away we go, and merrily, merrily, tolerably, tarry till the day is done. Age? Do you fancy you are elderly enough? Information I'm requesting on the subject interesting is a maiden all the better when she's tough.
True, tough is when demanding that's a general opinion that she'll last a good deal longer when she's tough.
Are you old enough to marry, do you think? Won't you wait until you're 80 in the shade? There's a fascination frantic in a ruin that's romantic. Do you think you are sufficiently decayed?
To the matter that you mention, I have gained some attention, and I think I am sufficiently decayed.
If that is so, sim, deri dum, deri, it's very good, very hard, take our one. Away we go, and merrily, merrily, tardily, tarry till day is done. If that is so, sim, deri dum, deri, it's very good, very hard, take our one. Away we go, and merrily, merrily, tardily, tarry till day is done. Sim, deri dum, deri, it's very good, very hard, take our one.
The Magic of Gilbert and Sullivan, a selection of our guest, Amy Jill Levine, on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Coming up, The Inquisition.